I'm going to ask Andrea Flinchum to come up and take it away. She's pinch hitting for Matthew Groenewald. And it's interesting for those of you who were at CSCE last year, you might remember that Matthew presented an NTM outbreak that had, guess what, a hot tub connection. So obviously there's a need for concerted prevention efforts on the hot tub front.
Well, and if anybody's going to be at APIC in a week and a half, then you have to come and hear my talk because I'll be talking more about those findings with the hot tub. And that was Mycobacterium molenskii. So, hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. I am not Matthew Groenewald, obviously, but I am pinch hitting, so forgive me up front if I mess up Matthew's presentation. So I'm going to talk to you about an investigation of Burkholderia capsipetia and infections among non-cystic fibrosis ICU patients in a Kentucky hospital. He has nothing to disclose, and neither do I. So Burkholderia capsipetia complex is a group of closely related gram-negative organisms, and they have at least these nine species, and these are a few of them listed here. It is also ubiquitous in the environment, found naturally in soil and water, and is an important pathogen in community and healthcare settings. This was previously known as Pseudomonas capsipetia. So of clinical importance, generally not pathogenic to those of us that are healthy and immunocompetent, but can cause chronic and potentially life-threatening illness, particularly respiratory infections in immunocompromised people and normally seen with CF patients. So horizontal transmission occurs with poor infection control practices such as poor hand hygiene, lack of disinfection of shared equipment, and inadequate disinfection of the environment. Boy, you get dry up here quick, don't you? Okay, sorry. Trying to go fast. So as a healthcare-associated pathogen, it is increasingly being recognized and it has been seen in some common disinfectants and is often resistant to antibiotics. And there have been some outbreaks in hospitalized non-CF patients, often in the intensive care units, around things that are used like ultrasound gel, nebulizers, and that sort of stuff. And so it suffices to say with this organism, it is inherently resistant, and it's not something you really want in your setting. So it's also been seen outside of hospitals in over-the-counter nasal spray and alcohol-free mouthwash. So, in October of 2013, we were notified by Hospital A that they had an apparent increase in non-CF B. capsipetia isolates. And what they reported to us initially was that there were 5 isolates in non-CF ICU patients during this time frame, 9/16 to 10/14 in 2013. 3 of those specimens were clinical and 2 of them were surveillance cultures. All of them were hospital acquired. And so we started talking to them and sort of advising them on what to look at next. So the objectives of our investigation in conjunction with the hospital were to determine the extent of the outbreak, identify the source of the infections and mode of transmission, and to implement effective infection control measures. And initially, the infection prevention program took this investigation on, and we sort of operated on the periphery. And while the hospital began their investigation, we had asked other hospitals in the state to look at their laboratory data in the same time frame and report any historical cases of B. capsipetia in non-CF patients. So Matthew, doing his wonderful data analysis magic, got 28 responses and figured that we were able to ascertain that statewide incidence of B. capsipetia of non-CF patients was 4.16 cases per 10,000 hospital bed months with a 95% confidence interval. And so assuming Hospital A had the same rate as the rest of the state, we would expect to see 2.37 cases during a given 10-month period. And at this point now, as we're moving through the investigation, we now have 11 cases that they have reported to us. So now I'm going to briefly describe the methods that we employed for this investigation. So we have a case definition, non-CF patient at Hospital A with a clinical or surveillance culture positive for Bisoplasia collected greater than or equal to 48 hours after admission after a negative surveillance culture on admission. And interestingly, this hospital really already had a robust surveillance program in place for their ICU division. They do surveillance cultures on all admissions to the ICU, and then once a week they culture everybody in the ICUs again, unless it's been less than 48 hours since the last culture. And they've been doing this for a long time. About 2006 they started that, so they seem to be pretty proficient and well-versed on this activity. So they started a chart review as well and looked for active case finding through retrospective and prospective means methods. Oops. And looked at case patient chart reviews to try to find some common exposures. So they did infection control observations. They looked at the laboratory for a potential pseudo outbreak. They reviewed all the medical solutions and products being used, talked to a physical respiratory therapist, nursing staff, looked at the endoscopy suite with bronchoscopies, and inquired about any changes. So at this point, we really haven't found anything, or they haven't found anything. We're still kind of on the outside, just giving them advice. So we asked if we could do a case control study. So we wanted to identify possible risk factors for Bisoplasia among these ICU patients. And now the study period is established 9/1/2013 to 1/1/14. So as you can see, we're moving around the calendar pretty quickly. At this point, now we have 15 case patients and 33 control patients. And actually, when we started the case control study, we had 17 cases and 34 controls, but for various reasons, those had to be excluded. So this is the data analysis that was done, pretty standard analysis of case control study data. And Matthew said, for you epi nerds, that was from him, not me. Additionally, we did environmental sampling, or the hospital did environmental sampling of these sites, and we did learn while they were talking, or we were talking to them about it, that they had a practice that was kind of questionable when they were loading up the bronch trays to put in the bronch carts that were stashed in the ICUs every evening. They would take the enzymatic cleaner that you use and pre-fill a lot of sterile cups and then load them into these bronch trays. So we're like, okay. Probably not a good practice. So now some results. So as you can see with our epi curve, that this has grown. You know, if you go looking for something, chances are you're going to find it. So by this time, this is when we were notified in October, we ended up with a total of 25 cases of Bisoplasia. And so we asked them to look back at the previous year. Now, these 25 cases are only in the ICU division, but if you look at the previous year, they had 7 cases, but that was hospital actually enterprise-wide, and that's more than one campus and more than one hospital. And then we have the 25 here. So we said, you have an outbreak, and they said, we have a cluster. So, you know, outbreak is not very palatable, but we try to use it often so that people get used to that. So then we started looking at chart reviews of these 25 patients. They were all located in the ICU division. 24 out of 25 were on mechanical ventilation. 19 out of 25 had bronchs. And but the ICUs were not common. They were in 5 different ICUs on totally different floors, and some of them were actually in different buildings on the same campus, but not necessarily in the same building. So they don't really have any ancillary staff that are shared because it's a pretty big geographic area. But after January 14, the occurrence of cases stopped magically. So some of our results from the infection control observations. There was no pseudo outbreak in the micro lab, per the micro lab. There were no obvious infection control lapses and no new medical solutions, no FDA reports on anything being recalled. They were not, no reusable product. I mean, everything looks perfect, right? Obviously, something is wrong. So they did identify a change in the use of a ventilator circuit filter, but this was a disposable part of the circuit, so it wasn't anything that had to be pasteurized and reused. Additionally, they did culture mouthwash just to make sure that that wasn't the issue and there was no growth. So now here's where Matthew comes in. Here is the analysis by individual risk factors. And so these risk factors had to be present for at least 2 days prior to their first positive culture. And so when you look at this, trachs and bronchs are what stand out as statistically significant, or statistically associated, I should say. And that was really all we found. So then, to analyze the combined effect of trachs and bronchs on the case status and to evaluate the effect of each of these risk factors while controlling for the other, we fitted two logistic regression models. Model A included only trach and bronch as predictors. And then Model B included trach and bronch and sacs, which had an elevated but non-significant odds ratio, and a mechanical ventilation, which was marginally significant, as predictors. And so, although the likelihood ratios suggest that Model A fits the data better, the results are similar for both models. After adjusting for potential confounders, only bronchoscopy remains significantly associated with case status. Case patients were nearly 12 times as likely to have had a bronch compared to controls. So not having enough information, we did further evidence for the hypothesis that the outbreak is related to bronchoscopy from a dose response analysis, which shows that the odds of being infected with B. sepatia increased as the number of bronchoscopies a patient had increased at least 2 days prior to the collection date of the first positive specimen. The chi-square for trend test indicated a strong, significant dose response relationship between bronchoscopy and case status. So, no mechanism to, we had no way to tie actually the specific scopes to the specific patients. There was not very good documentation at all. The endoscopy suite had a binder and they would record people coming in and they would place the little tags off of the, out of the reprocessor in there, but there was no way to match it up. And the therapeutic bronchs that occurred after hours, the documentation was even worse. I mean, you really had no idea who was doing what with these or with what bronch. So the environmental samples were all negative for B. sepatia, and it was really interesting because they made that caveat that they were negative for B. sepatia. They were positive for something, but they never would tell us what that was. So, conclusions. Oh, I think I went too far. Sorry. So, by February 2014, after doing routine inspection and preventative maintenance of the bronchoscope reprocessing equipment, because we really paid close attention to this for obvious reasons, it revealed that there was a supply water filter that had not been replaced on schedule. And so they replaced the filter, and then no cases were identified after January. We weren't entirely sure if the filter had ever been changed, if it would just miss the preventative maintenance schedule and somehow fell through the cracks, or if it just missed its date, you know, or if it had been there all along. So in conclusion, we had a B. sepatia outbreak occurring in Hospital A in 2013, beginning in September, possibly as early as May, and it ended without deliberate intervention. There was no environmental source identified, and we had a strong statistical association with bronchoscopy, and it ended after the replacement of the supply water filter. So contamination of a bronchoscope or bronchoscopes from a common source identified as most likely the cause of the outbreak. And so we recommended to them that they ensure that preventative maintenance is completed on schedule and that they shore up the documentation for bronchoscope, you know, record the serial number and the patient that it's being used on, and always consider bronchoscopes as a potential fomite when you're investigating these respiratory illnesses. And the other thing I have to say, and I think this happened with our Mycobacterium wilenskii and theirs as well, is from the HAI program, from my standpoint, it's really important for us to get our eyes on what's going on very, very quickly, because the facilities unintentionally have a very high threshold for actually seeing what's going on or what is wrong, you know, in the picture. So if we can get somebody else in there quickly, then sometimes these things can be averted a little bit faster. And that's all I have. Thank you for your attention. I feel like a marathon. I don't know if we have time for questions
or
not.
We do have time for questions. Anybody like to come to the mic? I guess, Andrea, while people are thinking about a question, I'm wondering about, you know, prevention strategies. You know, this probably isn't the only hospital that, you know, overlooks some basic maintenance. And, you know, in terms of how the hospitals manage scope reprocessing, is there a particular unit? Is there a pathway to those that reprocess bronchoscopes in particular?
Well, the reprocessing issue is huge, and you have to make sure that the people that are reprocessing are competent. So you always have to yearly have competencies for those people. It has to be on file. But the endoscopy suite and those people responsible for this should be able to keep track of it, but infection prevention departments need to be kept in the loop, and that stuff has to be given to them so that they can have it on record. And the other thing is, when preventative maintenance schedule should be provided to the infection prevention department. And when something goes wrong, you know, their antennas are up and they can start looking and watching and maybe doing surveillance so that you can nip this in the bud a lot quicker.
Yeah, that sounds very reasonable. It seems like you shouldn't have to wait for an outbreak to find out that you forgot to change a filter.
Right. And you know, they all operate outside of one another and in their silos, you know, the clinical people and the infection control and all that stuff.
Paul? Yeah, hi. Paul Cieslak, Oregon Health Authority. Nice presentation.
Oh, thank you.
I don't have any trouble believing that it was the bronchoscope.
No, I don't either. Yeah.
Just from an analysis standpoint, it occurs to me that your likelihood of having many bronchoscopies is going to be correlated with your duration of time spent in the ICU.
Absolutely.
And did you control for that in your analysis?
That's a really good question. I don't think so. I'll have to go back and look. You know, that's a great question, and I'll try to figure out the answer and tell you. Anybody else?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So you mentioned that they were doing surveillance cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Were they specifically doing that for this organism, or were they?
They started doing surveillance cultures on all ICU admits, and then actually every Monday they would do everybody again. Because of a quite lengthy and really hairy outbreak of multidrug-resistant Acinetobacter. And so that was one of the things that came out of that. And once you start doing those surveillance cultures, it's really hard to stop. You know, so they still do them.
Thanks again, Andrea.
Thank you.